Today is Tuesday. It's April 29th, 2025. And this is part 14 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Barbara Phillips. And Barbara spells her last name P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S. My name is Tom Martin. This oral history is being conducted at our kitchen table here in Flagstaff, Arizona. Good afternoon, Barb. How are you today?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Great. In this part 14 issue, part 14 interview, we are in the 1980s. It seems like there's a lot of things going on, some of which are still going on today.
Right.
But one of the things that happened in the 1980s that I was wondering if you could talk about was this MX missile survey.
Site survey.
So pick that up. What was going on with that?
Well, Steve Crothers was still head of the department.
Okay.
At the museum, so it would have been, I'd have to look the exact date up, but late 70s, early 80s.
Okay.
Before he left the museum. And he got asked to do some contract work with a big environmental company who subcontracted part of it into Botany.
Okay,
so another person working with Steve was Goldberg. What's her first name? Anyway, Goldberg.
Okay.
And she did the bird work on this. And I was hired to work on the botany.
Okay.
And the subcontracting company contracted another botanist to help me with the project. So I flew out of Flagstaff on a very small plane to Las Vegas, Nevada, and met the other people that were working on the project. They put us up in a hotel in Vegas for overnight, and then we drove up in Nevada to the sites.
Okay.
And they had picked out for studying the possible effects of building missile silos in the ground, all the things that would involve, you know, blasting and all that kind of thing, and what possible effects it might have on springs in the very remote areas that they were looking at. And they had areas chosen in both Nevada and Utah that were basically way out in the boonies, and they had sites that had springs and sites without springs, and, you know, sort of control sites type format. And there were several of us in the group that we went out there. As I said, there was only me and another lady for being the botany group, and then there were people that did birds, got up early in the morning and looked at all the birds and in the evening.
Okay.
And then there were people that trapped small mammals and looked for big animal signs and things like that. So there were 6 to 8 of us in this various thing, and we camped together.
You know, I've got a question for you that kind of more about the concept of MX. It seems like for a while the concept was they were going to build like a tunnel system for miles and miles and miles underground, and then run these things around so the Russians wouldn't know where they were, because they couldn't see them with their satellites.
Yeah.
And then they were going to pop these things up and they could shoot them off. But then they talked about putting them on flatbeds and driving around. I don't know, going to hide them. Do you remember, was this like, because yeah, to launch these things, if they're going to do it from a railroad underground, they're going to have tunnels coming up to the surface.
Right, yeah. I don't know the specifics of the project. All I know is what we had to do as biologists, as a team, and we went out there.
Mm.
And so it was a very short project as far as I was concerned.
Short, like a few days or a few weeks or a few months?
Yeah, a couple of weeks in June and a couple of weeks in July.
June, July in a hot desert.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So that's what we were doing. The campsite in that I remember the most, we were near basically a cattle pond. but it was a large one, and it was fenced off, so the cattle didn't get their water from the pond that was there.
Okay.
And we were able to swim in it.
Oh, wow.
Because it actually had a little a wharf kind of thing going out, and we could get to the deeper water, and we could swim in it. Uh-huh. And as you said, it was very hot. And we'd be doing sweaty things all day long. It was really nice to have that kind of refreshing things. And also these places where we camped, we had trees. A couple of the sites didn't have trees. There was versus trees and springs versus, you know, no trees and springs and stuff. So they were sort of like a match where you have a control. And see, you know, I mean, the treed area would obviously have a lot more birds and things and possibly other animals. That would be different vegetation.
Right.
And then the non-treed one would be, you know, it would have low-growing shrubs and plants that grow in the water and things like that, but it didn't have the tree.
Right.
So that whole part of the setup was set up before I got involved with the site.
Okay.
But I went out in June. And like I said, I had an assistant, and we would get up after the people that went out early in the morning, and then we'd go out and do our things. And one thing I remembered at one site was we were hiking down, trying to plan to go directly down to the end where the spring was and stuff like that. And a northern harrier was evidently nesting down there.
Oh, wow.
And we got dive bombed by this harrier. And we did not want to get hit by the knuckles of a bird coming at us.
Yeah.
It was really,
fairly large hawks,
aren't they? Yeah, they are. Yeah. So we didn't quite get down to the springs on that one. And then we went over to another one. We had sites in Nevada and sites in Utah. And in between, we stayed in a hotel and washed our laundry and bought more groceries. And we were camping out, tenting and camping out, bought more groceries and stuff. And then we all went as a team over to the one in Utah.
Okay.
And
this is like southern Utah? Or
it's about mid-Utah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's very remote. There, you know, obviously, it's the road that went from Utah to Nevada.
Okay.
But we were like in the middle of each state.
Okay.
The eastern part of Nevada and the western part of Utah. But the middle up and down.
And it's all basin and range country.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's some big basins out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So we found, and the one that I remember the most in Utah had some large trees. And I remember that they had great horned owls up in the top of the tree when we got there, and the babies were bigger than the parents.
Oh my gosh.
It was just so funny to see them, and they were sitting up there all fluffy and everything, but not really fledged yet, you know, and looking down at us and everything. And so the other girl and I, and I'll get her name later, I followed up on her, but anyway, we were going to run a transect. We all had transects, so there was a boardwalk there, and there was water in the tank, and she was taking the transect line out, and then we were going to look at the vegetation, you know, just adjacent to the boardwalk, and so we were doing 100-meter line, and I was standing on the shore end, and she was going out this boardwalk, and I said, you got to go, you know, a little further. We're not far enough, And she says, well, it's sort of weird out here. And I said, well, but, you know, we just need this extra distance, you know, like this. And all of a sudden I heard kerplop. And she goes like, ah, you know.
So right through the boardwalk?
No, it was the end of the boardwalk.
Oh,
you know, into this mucky pond. And she came out on the boardwalk and she goes like, yuck. And she came out and she stripped all her clothes down to her underwear. And so we were the only women in the group. I think there might have been another one, but she didn't care. She was getting out of these yucky clothes.
Yep.
And anyway, and so I remember that incident from that too. And then it was buggy, you know, because there was water.
Yeah.
So they were buggy, and there was like grass all over, and we didn't notice it that much in June. But by July, when we went back, it was like cheek grass, and it got all in our socks and everything. Wow. And so our legs got really itchy from that. And when we went back to this one site where she had fallen in, it had completely dried up. And so there wasn't any more water in July. And we went out there, and there was a dead cow.
Oh, wow.
There. So I don't know if it died before or after she had fallen into the water, but she was right to think that it was really yucky out there.
Yeah.
Anyway, so then we packed up the plants. We were collecting plants and to ID everything. We ran out lines, like I said, 100 meter lines, and we did transects of what the different vegetation was, both on land where we start, and then as you go into the pond.
Okay.
And then, you know, that sort of thing. And so the vegetation would change as you went through it.
I'm assuming there wouldn't have been any cactus in the,
no,
in the pond
we didn't,
area, but
we didn't probably run into much in the way of cactus, but it would be shrubland, you know, there, a lot of sagebrush and that kind of thing, just around the ponds.
And of course, so, heavily grazed.
Yeah, well, depending on the fencing and that sort of thing, some were probably grazed and some were not grazed so much. But then we collected the plants to verify what they were and put them in plant presses. And so I'd get a plant press that was like, you know, this big. And then I'd, you know, we were there a week or 10 days at a time. So there was time for some of the plants to dry out and everything. So then you could take them out of the plant press and stuff. But I still ended up with quite a bit of plant material in papers and things like that to fly back. And we'd go back to Las Vegas and had a flight from Las Vegas back to, I had a flight from Las Vegas back to Flagstaff.
Okay.
And I just remember that they took my plant presses and put them in pods on the, in the wings of the plane. And plane was about 11 passenger plane. It was not very big planes that we flew on. And the route back was Las Vegas to Cedar City, I think, and then to Page, and then to Flagstaff.
Oh, wow, okay.
So it was, I got to see, you know,
some
up close.
Country.
Yeah, some country that way.
Did you find any peo cactus on that trip?
No.
Okay.
No, and I'm sure what cactus we did find were probably just, you know, punches and things like that.
Okay.
I don't remember. It was mostly water plants. We were just trying to see the vegetation there. I remember a lot of sedges and rushes and things like that for in the water.
Around the water.
Cattails and stuff.
Yeah.
And then we, of course, had grassland kind of species. And then we had whatever trees were there. So you had, you know, if you had cottonwoods or willows or things like that, then you would collect specimens. You want to document it by having a specimen and located, you know, this pond, that pond, whatever, because it's as detailed as possible to make decisions. I mean, they were going to make decisions on possible impacts.
Right, locations.
Doing that. I was not involved in the decision-making process, and the fact, you know, our company was just a subcontract to, I mean, the museum was subcontracting to a subcontracting to a main company.
Exactly.
So, I mean, we were
a few steps down.
And I remember at one time, after I handed in my report and everything and gotten my, you know, plants ID'd and everything, and I was through with the project, basically, I didn't get paid.
Oh.
And I handed it in. I'd handed everything in. And so after a month or so of not getting paid, and I was living off of, you know, small projects, I called them up and said, you know, when's my check going to come? I've handed in my hours. I've finished the project. And, and they said, oh, well, we haven't been paid by the main contractor. And I said, that is your problem, not my problem.
Right.
I fulfilled my job to you. And I actually went to a lawyer, and he, you know,
wrote up a little letter
and by golly, I got paid. So that was my first introduction to the lawyer business there. But so that was a interesting project, a different one.
Yeah.
And
what else was going on in the 1980s?
Well, in the early 80s, like I said, we sort of at the museum had change of people or directors and such. And I don't know if we talked about that, some of the main biologists there had decided to go look at other possibilities. And so a couple of them went to the NAU. One of them, that was Peter Price, was the first one.
Right.
And Tom Whittem was going, but he'd put in for an NSF grant. And since the grant was awarded to the museum, the museum had to keep him for at least a year, because that they couldn't, you know, change the money over to the NAU. And another fellow, I have to remember his name, but anyway, he didn't have his NSF grant come through right away. And so he let a person go. And Art was concerned that this person wouldn't have, you know, didn't have a job. He'd lost his job, you know, because the grant hadn't come through. And so Art talked to him, and he said, well, what are you going to do? And he says, well, I think I'm going to go hiking over in China and, you know, take some time off and do that. And we thought, oh, well, maybe we don't have to be so concerned with him if he's got enough money to take off in those days, you know, to take off
to and
travel and everything. Uh-huh. And then, he obviously was not going to do that on his side pay as an assistant.
Did Art take over then for Peter Price?
No, he took over for Steve Carruthers.
Okay.
Steve realized the writing on the wall ahead of time and worked it out that Art could be the head of the department. And
so this is when Steve left, or was
he stayed there?
Okay,
he stayed there.
That. I was confused about that.
Yeah. No, he stayed there for another year or so and figured out how to establish a company separate, you know, from the museum. And, you know, he was good at writing grants and good at getting contracts and stuff like that going. And so,
Yeah, so
he was able to stay there for a little bit. Art became a curator of you know, the botany section.
Okay.
And we still were able to get grants, and we got more grants from Fish and Wildlife Service on rare plants.
Okay.
Because we had proved that we could find them, and we, like I said, it was building up after the Endangered Species Act was signed and stuff. So we ended up with major, well, not major contracts, but continuous contracts for looking for rare plants all over the state.
So then when Steve left M&A and started SWCA, which I think it's his middle initial.
It's his initial, Stephen
Warren
Carruthers.
Okay, Carruthers, SWCA Associates.
Yeah.
Then did he get contracts and subcontract back out to you guys at M&A?
Not really during that time period, I don't remember.
Okay.
But I found out, well, years later, that when we left the museum in 1990, both Art and I left because we found better jobs. Well, I found three openings in botany came along in 1990.
Okay.
The Arboretum at Flagstaff had been established. The university had a position in of the curator of the herbarium and teaching classes at the university.
Okay.
And the Forest Service had decided to advertise for a botanist.
Oh, wow.
Position. So there were three openings, which was unusual in Flagstaff to have that all at the same time.
Yeah.
And so I applied for the Arboretum, and the Forest Service.
Okay.
I had already done some teaching of classes in plants of Arizona, Northern Arizona, just general botany, and decided I didn't really want to be a teacher at NAU. You know, I'd done about three classes just to do it, but I decided, so I applied for the Arboretum and I applied for the Forest Service job.
Okay.
I'd already, in the mid-80s, I did some contract work with the Forest Service.
Okay.
As I said, I was on contracts. So I could diversify into any area that, you know, these things came up, and I was qualified. So I did some surveys on rare plants. The groundsel, San Francisco Peaks groundsel, it was on the top of the San Francisco Peaks. We did surveys across the whole contour of the top of the peaks in the alpine zone.
Okay.
And
so this would have been Agassiz and Fremont and Doyle.
Yeah, but primarily Humphreys and Agassiz to begin with.
Okay.
And then we did go to those other tops later.
I wanted to ask you, up on Agassiz, there was a helicopter that crashed up there in 1961.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you
know where it was. I didn't stumble on it, but I know by the, you could see it. The light was just right. It would show the site.
So this isn't the
not the plane. Okay, you're talking about something different.
This is a much smaller helicopter.
I don't recall running across that. No,
because I just wondered.
No, I knew about the bomber, where that was.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Yeah. So anyway, so Paul Boucher was working with the Forest Service in about 84, 85. And Greg Goodwin was the biologist that was in charge at the supervisor's office level.
Okay.
And so they ran contracts out, and I did some follow-up surveys on things that Paul had found. You know, like he would find some plants someplace, and then they needed more surveys done around where he had found them there was some work going to be done that might, you know, injure plants in that area. So the surveys were selected based on the locations of the plants, but mainly on what impacts might be coming along that they would have to be concerned about, which means they aren't a thorough survey of the habitat of the rare plants.
Okay.
There are surveys within potential habitat.
Like if they were going to put in a pipeline,
right,
you wouldn't look at the whole habitat area, you just look at the pipeline.
Right, area. Or you would work, most of them like thinning of the forests, things like that, where they'd be coming in with machinery, where they were going to pile the logs, you know, things like that.
Hmm.
And so I worked on two other plants other than the groundsel. The main ones I worked on was one called Arizona bugbane.
Okay.
And that grew in the drainages. And that was one we looked at for being listed.
Okay.
Because it was pretty rare. Hmm. It's very found in about four locations in Arizona.
Okay.
It's a remnant from, you know, hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago.
Okay.
I was on 3-4, well, no, later. That's later. Never mind. So when I was still in the 80s, I was still working at the museum.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked for that species, following
for
up
the
on Paul's.
Service.
Yeah, for the, no, for the Forest Service,
for the
but
Forest
I was
Service,
working
yeah.
for the museum.
Okay, yes, exactly.
I was on contracts.
You know, I wanted to go back to something else that happened in the early 80s, which was a pretty wet winter, a couple winters in a row there, lots of water everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see any interesting things happen with regards to the plants in the northern Arizona high plateaus based on this excessive water that might have surprised you?
Right. Well, two of our species that I had to look for in this time period were the one that's called a Flagstaff Pennyroyal.
Okay.
And it's a small mint that grows on limestone rocks,
huh.
A very specialized layer of the limestone rock. And it occurs right next to the Lake Marys.
Okay.
In that area.
Okay.
So it occurs on a little bit of rock outcrops that then go out into sort of points, and in that area the water would come up in the lakes.
Okay.
And could be, and the water would be, you know, running down the streams into the lake. So you get both water moving in this way, and then water coming up this way.
Coming up in the reservoir.
Yeah. And so part of my work later, you know, later years, I don't remember it right then, but that was one aspect of it, you know. So later we did run into a case where the water rose so much that it was right into that habitat.
Oh.
But normally they were up on sort of the slopey part of the...
I'm assuming they, if they were up on the slopey, rocky parts, they didn't like inundation by water.
I don't think they liked it very much, no.
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
So, anyway, and then there was another one that we worked on there that I did surveys in the 80s, and then when I actually worked for the Forest Service, came back and had to do it according to, you know, like I said, the impacts of the work on the forest. But another one was called...
That's all right. Well,
Well, it was another Arizona.
Okay.
It was in the Rose family.
Arizona native.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there's an unusual form of it in the Flagstaff area that was only known from
like a
from
cliff
Flagstaff.
Type,
no. It's actually it's not. It's in the Buttercup.
Okay.
It's going to take me a minute to get my plant straight here.
No worries.
But and the Hedioma sort of lived in similar habitat. Not exactly the same habitat, but all the time. But some of the time they were. And they were around these Lake Marys.
Okay. All right.
So that was that.
So you applied then for Forest Service and the Arboretum.
I had contracts with them in the 80s.
Right, but then kind of moving off into early 90, 1990, eventually Art's going to walk away from the museum.
Yeah.
And so are you.
We quit at basically the same time.
Why did you quit?
You know, we were sort of the remnant of the contracting kind of people at the museum.
Okay.
And so the archaeology had diminished a lot. Steve had left with the biologists.
Okay.
So we had botany things going on. But I think we had covered most of the plants in the state.
Okay.
So
that heady day of the,
it was
70s
sort of,
with all the contracts and
right,
then into the 80s and then and Steve
then
left,
the,
so he would have taken contracts.
And so the number of people at the museum even was still, you know, diminishing as far as people,
okay.
You know, the ones that we knew when we got there, some of them had been, you know, let go. And, but we did a lot of, we still did a lot of work while we were there. We did some plateaus where we wrote issues of plateau on plants.
Okay.
We wrote one on spring wildflowers.
And that's the quarterly newsletter for the museum.
It's changed over the years and is to where they put the emphasis. They have like some bulletins that were more scientific. Then they started doing some that were more for the public, but still educational.
Okay.
And they changed formats and that over time too. But we did this a spring wildflower one and a fall wildflower one.
Okay.
And we did one on Sea Harp Miriam and the Life Zones, and that was in 1989 at the 100th year centennial of when Sea Harp Miriam came to Arizona and did his life zone studies up on the San Francisco peaks.
Okay.
So I did a lot of the background work on that particular one. We had an exhibit at the museum.
Okay.
And I interviewed people that that were related to Sihart Miriam, there was somebody that did a biography on him.
Okay.
And another person that did a biography on his sister.
Oh, okay.
And then there was a niece or something like that that was a descendant that was still alive.
Okay.
That I talked with her a bit.
Cool.
And so I did a lot of research on Sihart Miriam. Okay. and I ordered some of his collecting tools and things like that from different places where they were at other museums.
Oh, uh-huh.
And brought them in, or similar things to what is mentioned in his documents. I got all his, he had a sidekick. Can we shut this?
It's all right. It's fine.
So I'm just trying to think of names.
I didn't spend time this morning thinking
about stuff, but anyway.
But it's interesting that you brought in some of Miriam's
real stuff
and put that in the exhibit.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And we also we hired an assistant. We often had an assistant for us, Art and I.
Okay.
And we, the first one we offered it from, you know, NAU student, you know, type thing.
Ah.
And the first one we had taken a different job. So we ended up getting a lady who was actually in art. And
okay.
We thought, well, what are we going to do? Well, we had to work on this exhibit.
Ah,
and she was
yeah.
an art major.
Great.
And it just happened, you know, she was able to be very helpful. And we made like a paper mache mountain of the San Francisco peaks.
Oh,
and we made the life zones, put the life zones on it, you know, and we had it on
cool.
this table. And so we had that. And then we had copies of photos. I contacted the Smithsonian. I got
okay.
information that they had there. I got a microfiche of his journal, Sihart Miriam's journal.
Okay.
Which, of course, a journal has incomplete things of it and stuff
yep.
like that. The names of the plants and the animals have changed. So there was some work that had to be done in relation to that.
Okay.
They had a microfiche reader at NAU. I went to Klein Library in their collections area and got help looking at photos of Flagstaff at the same time period.
Okay.
Not necessarily of Miriam. There were some of Miriam's actual group, but also of people doing things in Flagstaff. Like I had some people going on horseback, you know, sitting side saddle women going on horseback up to the top of Agassiz in the saddle up there on the
right.
Weatherford Road,
right.
That area. Things
that
like that to document
Al
what
Doyle
was going
and
up
his
around.
Son Lee were doing.
Yeah.
In the late 1800s, early 1900s, was leading people by horseback.
Yeah.
Up to the peaks.
Right. Now this is 1889, but still,
right.
you know,
right.
it's
that time period. Yeah.
There
yeah.
was a little book that was like Flagstaff Woe or something like that. It was a very small book, but it had a lot of information about the cattle coming in and the sheep ranchers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I could get background information that, you know, it wasn't just like reading a whole book just on Miriam and then that was it.
Right.
You had to get things to fill
what
in
happening.
What happened
yeah.
around the
yeah.
area.
Yeah.
So we made this exhibit.
Cool.
And it was a really neat exhibit. And Jim Babbitt came and looked at it and he said, oh my goodness, I'm learning things about Flagstaff that I didn't know. And
oh, wow.
he was supposed to be one of the, you know, Flagstaff historians.
Yeah.
yeah, and everything. So he talked to Francis McAllister, who was, you know, Francis
right.
McAllister was, had started the Arboretum basically in 1981 or so, and told her, hey, you got to look at this exhibit and you know, she got interested in it.
Okay.
So then she's contracted with me to write up two things. One, how to make an exhibit like this.
Okay.
using the photos of the exhibit, you know, like the papier-mâché mountain and stuff like that in this thing. So slides. And she hired a photographer to take pictures of all the stuff that we had in the exhibit.
Cool.
And then she hired me to write up how to make an exhibit. Mm-hmm. And then we wrote, both Art and I wrote up this plateau on Sea Heart Miriam and the Life Zone project. So there was so there was a secondary thing of how to make the exhibit and then on the life of Sea Heart Miriam himself.
Got it.
With photos from the exhibit. And nice. That was
Hey Barb, what do you remember about Frances? A pillar of the community here.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, she was on the board of the museum and started the Arboretum at Flagstaff. And there is a whole biography of her that's very, very complete.
Cool.
And I've read it, and she had a fascinating life. And she started out just an ordinary person in an ordinary home, and her, you know, her mother got sick and died, and so she didn't have a charmed life her whole life. Hmm. And people knew her after, you know, she was a pillar here in Flagstaff, but, you know, her life was a more of an ordinary person for a long time in California. And she got married and with college person.
Okay.
And then they divorced, and then she got married again, and that person happened to be quite wealthy.
Okay.
But then he got sick with a brain tumor, and so a lot of their married time he was not able to function very well, and he had to be he lived in a home with you know, since they had some money and everything like that, with care and stuff like that. But they adopted a boy, a baby boy, and she became a single mother raising him. And then after her husband died, the second one, she settled in Flagstaff full time, and then got very interested in, you know, the museum and had this home and she made the Arboretum, but had a home built out there and part of the land.
Okay.
And eventually the cabin that they had lived in was moved out there too. So that's at the Arboretum. So she got the Arboretum started. She wanted it to really be part of the museum, but the museum didn't really see itself going in that direction to have, you know, an arboretum associated with the museum. So, you know, it's out on Woody Mountain Road, which was pretty remote. But
so let me tactfully ask you about this, thinking about Harold Colton and the vision of the Coltons for the museum.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like it opened up a ton of opportunities. The archaeology of Glen Canyon, this very strong archaeological arm, which eventually shut down.
Well, it's not completely shut down,
you know, kind of cut way back, if you will. And then the botany and sort of expanding and then
contracting.
Cut way back. And then I was thinking about recently the whole Seeps and Springs option and cut way back.
Yeah.
Is it more that the Coltons' vision of the museum was just a museum kind of thing, and everybody else is bombarding the museum with these good ideas that expand and then contract? Or is the museum being presented with good ideas that it doesn't, it kind of not wants to invest into, or is it a bit of both?
Well, some parts of it, like the Coltons, people would keep talking about the Coltons' vision, and that sort of thing. The archaeology was related to the anthropology of working with the tribes. That was really strongly emphasized when we first came to the museum. The people would go out and go, you know, meet the people on the land and get things from them and bring them back and have the shows. And they really worked on encouraging art and things that they knew that the rest of the culture in the United States or whatever would be interested in, to try to both help them financially, but also help awareness of, you know, hey, this is the culture that right. was here when we came, and
yes,
you know,
very,
that sort of thing. So there was very much an education.
Very much the Native Indigenous peoples.
Yeah. And we had people from the different tribes working at the museum just as regular employees while we were there.
Right.
And the people, even people like a geologist like Bill Breed, were friends with different people there, and he continued to go out on the res for the dances and those sort of things all his life,
right.
and that I knew him.
But that would make sense that the Colton's vision was really more an anthropological vision. So
right.
So the concepts of Sepsis Springs and botany and those things, not quite.
But there's tie-in. I mean,
plants yes.
because of the herbal nature of the
absolutely.
Tribe.
You can't survive if you don't pay attention to the plants.
And the animals, they were a little bit of an offshoot, but they, and the
but
Grand Canyon.
The paleontology that's a little outside the wheelhouse of anthropology.
Definitely whomever they hired had their own abilities, their own strengths and things like that.
Right.
And so, we were, like I mentioned, Art was hired because the botanist that they did have was going back to college. And so, here's an opening. We already have the grants here.
Right.
We can fund you because you're, on this grant. And then we got the other ones on rare plants because there weren't very many botanists in Arizona that were, there were
specializing
a couple,
in that.
Well, and they were the people at the universities, and that was about it.
Okay.
We didn't have all these contract things going on.
Okay.
And the first contract archaeology, I think, sort of started around the same time, too, where they were doing road work or whatever, and they didn't want to just destroy whatever they was there. So
in a way, it sounds like the museum actually was a springboard for a lot of different things, sort of to help them get going and then send them on their way to either make it or not on their own, but sort of helped assist to get these things started, but always would fall back then on its mission.
Well, and I've been thinking about that too, because, some people said, once you get to a museum, you're just going to stay there the rest of your life. Well, no. I mean, we were young people coming in, and today it's still the same way. It's young people come in, and then it doesn't pay all that well.
Right.
Then you find, or your ideas of what you want to do with your life changes, or you see more opportunities somewhere else, and we moved on. Mm. We came right after grad school, and we're there 15 years or so, 14 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then moved on.
Right.
And then other people came along and, they were there. I mean, even Dave Gillette, who just recently died, he wasn't there to begin with, he came in and he started working on dinosaurs and things like that. Well, they were in Utah and they were here and there. And so it was a good place to be and be stationed and stuff, but it wasn't like he was going to, necessarily stay there. He did stay there till he retired, but...
Right.
You don't come in thinking that necessarily. You look for opportunities as they come along. Like I was always on soft money, so therefore, when the money maybe started to dwindle, and then of course Art and I had separated, we were already divorced by the time we were looking for these other jobs.
Okay.
We still worked together. We were very friendly working together, and we continued that.
Mm-hmm.
But, I was talking to somebody today that said, back in the day, you just sort of grew up and you knew that you were going to do this, 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 and this, and you did it because that's where the money was, but that you didn't have the choices. And people today are more flexible.
Right.
We were sort of the in-between kind of flexible.
Well, if you're on a grant, that's different than having a job at the water plant. You know, where there's some sort of a stable, we're going to need this position of a firefighter for a long time. You can work your way up the ladder, in quotes, it's kind of a joke, and you can become the captain someday. Well, not everybody can be the captain, so eventually people are going to have to diversify out of that.
So I always look back on what we did and feel like I was just very lucky that I loved what I did. But it was interesting enough that it kept changing. And so, yes, we did this and I did that, but it wasn't forever. It wasn't like you said, that you weren't a gas station mechanic or something like that your whole life. You were able to look at the next opportunity and move along and move. And it was, and for my case, it was still botany, but it was a different kind of botany. I started out in paleobotany back in college, and then I, you know, worked with making slides of plants, and I got allergic to that. So then I moved over to, you know, working in a herbarium that didn't use chemicals, and going out in the field, and
became an expert in pedocactus.
Well, eventually, So, it was just taking it's a a journey, and other people did the same thing. And so, I just feel lucky now that there's still some botany at the museum. It's a little different than it was, but we're still writing some grants, proposals, and getting some funding. And so there's a thread of continuity through it all. And yet there's some suspense of where you're going to be going, you know, 2 years down the road or whatever. And that's, you know, more for the younger people than it is for those of us who are retired. But it also makes it interesting. And it's always been interesting. It's not boring. It's, you're learning something all the time. You're meeting new people. It's just sort of, I think I chose the right kind of a job. I mean, for, you know, starting out on a farm with apples and peaches and pears. And
so you mentioned that you got divorced from art. Was that in the late 80s, 89?
That was mid-80s. That was 1985.
Okay.
Yeah, it was, you know, sort of sudden, but not so sudden. I mean, we realized that we were better working together and better as friends and had our different opinions. We didn't have kids. We, they didn't appear to be coming along. So we didn't have that sort of thing to, you know, I don't know. It just happened. And, but like I said, we stayed friends and we worked on projects until he retired and moved to Colorado, after his wife died, another wife died, and but we're still friends. We still get together at least once a year, and you know, go on short trips and things like that. So it wasn't.
And then 1990, Art left the museum.
And he ended up working for Steve Carruthers at SWCA. Some on lots of different projects, which I wasn't quite aware of at the time. I ended up going, getting a job with the Forest Service, and it was on three forests, the Coconino, Kaibab, and Prescott forests. The Kaibab forest is, you know, based in Williams, so it's outside of the Flagstaff area. I was responsible for getting some projects going there in botany on rare plants again.
So that was the Kaibab, the Coconino, and the which one?
Prescott.
Prescott. Oh, okay. Wow, that's a lot. It's a big area.
Yeah, very big area.
Okay. And what was your, were you like botanist at large or what?
Region, and what'd they call me? Zone botanist. They called people that were on more than one district on a forest zone, and then I was more on three forests, so I was called zone.
Okay.
But I was, for a while, the only botanist on the forests in Arizona.
Wow.
So I actually did some work on the ABRS and some work with the Tano National Forest. And
Okay.
Short term, sometimes there was another botanist on them, and eventually, but there were people that knew plants that were range people.
Okay.
On the forest too, but on the ones that I was on,
were you
I was
looking
the
on
botanist.
The Sky Islands in southern Arizona as well?
No, okay. I didn't do that. Okay. And some on at one point they did hire somebody. Off and on, but they weren't as consistent.
Okay.
But the Coronado National Forest covers a lot of the Skyline Islands.
Okay. And I'm just trying to fit this in here because I know you also started working for the Hualapai Tribe.
That was Art that did that.
Art did that. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I worked on river trips with people, not just Art, but a couple other people too that worked with the Hualapai Tribe, but I didn't have the contracts.
Got it.
I was working as an assistant because I knew the flora.
Was that in the 1990s then that Art had that contract when he was working with Steve?
He started working once he went off on his own from the museum. Mm-hmm. He started working with the tribes too.
Okay.
So he worked with the Hualapais, Kaibab Paiutes. He worked with the Navajos. He worked with, I don't think he did much with the Hopis. And he might have worked some with the Havasupais. But he definitely kept working with the tribes and the elders and projects like, you know. And some of that work got sent to southern Arizona as far as working with the...
Tohono O'odham?
But I meant the... government organizations that worked with the tribes.
Oh, okay. And, the Bureau of Indian Affairs kind of thing? Or? No. Okay.
No.
All right.
No, it's it's like the parks group that...
Ethnobotany sort of thing?
Yeah,
or?
Yeah, uh-huh. Definitely. But it was all not to get out to the public information because it's their private...
It's their internal workings, which makes sense.
Yeah, the tribes.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But when I was on the forest, the Kaibab Forest, we had grants to give out, and people could apply for them, and they had an upper limit of what we would pay. I think it was like $25,000 or something like that.
Okay.
And so we'd put out a bid for that, and Art was bid on them, and he got a couple of them that way. And so he did surveys on the North Kaibab and South Kaibab, some of them were, but for particular species of rare plants. And also did surveys, like I said before, project areas. You know, they would know that in the next 10 years we're going to be going in here and cutting the trees out, or we're going to go out in these meadows and maybe burn them or do this or that. And we want to know what's going to be impacted in these areas. And so then he would go out and survey those and write up reports on all that kind of thing.
All right.
So he kept working on that.
That makes sense. Just going to look at the time here. 53 minutes. So we talked about this a little bit earlier today, and so I do want to ask you about this because it would have been in the early 90s, I think, when you would have been, or the Forest Service, hang on, let me think about this. No, it would have been the Bureau of Land Management. And in conjunction with Grand Canyon National Park, would have been called to a construction site at Marble Canyon with the construction of the second Navajo Bridge, which would have required a new road to be cut through undisturbed land.
Right.
And there's somebody would have to go up and do a survey on that.
Yeah.
It was private land on the Fredonia side, but there was also Glen Canyon National Recreation land over there, so there were three agencies involved.
Right. And I did do the surveys for the rare cactus up there with the Navajo botanist, Donna House. And Donna and I did several surveys on the reservation because... we were both good surveyors, and we were interested in the same species.
Okay.
And so...
cool.
Yeah, so we did that. And that would have been at the time I was at the museum. So the late 80s, I think. Late 80s. When you're okay. saying they put in the bridge.
Well, they were doing the compliance work in the late 80s.
Yeah.
To
yeah.
try to, what are we going to yeah. do and how are
right.
we going to do it?
Right, yeah. yeah. So okay. we were out there treading oh. in around there and, yeah.
How did you meet Donna?
I don't remember originally, but probably just at some meeting of okay. botanists in northern Arizona with, okay. you know, could have been through the Arboretum, because I did do a little bit of work with the Arboretum.
Okay.
The Arizona strip work that I did in the Woodruff collection was done in the 80s.
Okay.
And, you know, like I said, I was a freelance, basically. I most of my contracts were through the museum, but not all of them. And I worked for a number of different companies. They would get, you know.
Did you work for Steve, SWCA?
I did. I actually did. I worked on the Peabody Coal project.
Did you know Jim Ullman?
The name sounds familiar, but that's not the person I worked with directly. But, I was more freelance than Art was, because he was paid a salary by the museum, and I was separate from, I mean, they probably took the grant money and put it into the salary money that they were paying him, but
I
was directly on the grant funding part of different grants, so I had a whole bunch of different companies that I worked for in that time period. And, of course, and you know, after... Well, we can go into more 80s work, too, because I really need to go into that in more detail, too.
Like but, what? What are you thinking about?
Well, the Pediococcus I'm currently working on.
Okay.
Yeah, which is the 40th year of working on that
What's
species.
The name of that? What's the species?
Pediococcus. Pediococcus.
Mm-hmm.
Peebleseanus.
How do you spell that?
Peebleseanus. Subspecies, the same name.
Okay.
And there is another subspecies called Ficicinii.
How do you spell that?
Ficicinii.
Ficinii.
Ficicin. You got an S-E-N there.
F-I-C-K-S-E-S-I-N?
No, F-I-C-K.
Yep.
I.
Yep.
S-E-N.
Got it. Okay.
I-A-E.
Okay.
It might have changed. I'll have to look at the ending again.
Uh-huh.
Because when they became two subspecies instead of two varieties, the endings on the last name changed.
Okay.
So there's a whole nomenclature thing in there that's all involved with that, yeah.
Okay.
But, that started in the 1970s, late 70s, when we went out. I went out with another lady from the museum surveying, trying to find even, we had a collection location, like I said, for different species.
Mm-hmm.
So we had this description of where we ought to look, but it was a vague description.
Okay.
And so she and I went out and we took a truck out and drove around old roads that we could find around on. And finally we went up on this land and seemed to be sort of like where it should be. And we were looking around. We didn't see it. We'd never seen the cactus really, except for in the picture, you know. And so we went out there. And finally, I said, well, this is boring, you know, and look, let's go over and look at that petrified wood over there. And we went over, and there was this plant flowering away, and I went, this is our plant. So at first, we thought it was associated with petrified wood, you know, thinking if it was rare or whatever. Turned out that isn't the case.
Or more the soil type.
It's more the soil type, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we didn't know that at first. But anyway, we were like successful after about 2 or 3 days of looking around on all these hills and everything. We finally found it. And then that listed, that ended up, we were able to work on it as, you know, having found the type locality and you know, look at how many plants were there and things like that. And it was obviously very rare. And
so that's the Chinle?
The Shinarup conglomerate. Shinarup conglomerate of the Chinle Formation.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's only one
right,
layer.
That's a
of
super
the,
specific.
Yeah, very specific. And it's even the just a special type of that Chinarup. So it's not everywhere.
So it should be called the...
Yeah, it was named after people. It was named after Peebles. Peebles was a...
Peebles petrified wood eye.
Well, it's not associated with the petrified wood.
No, it's not. But very specific rock type where you will find petrified wood. Mm-hmm. And that's crazy.
But there's a lot of different... Chinle has a lot of different petrified woods.
That's,
kinds
and
of
a lot of different
layers
rock
and
types.
All of that.
Yeah.
But anyway, so that was interesting. And...
I'm wondering if this is a good place to put a comma in this oral history series. And next time we will kind of walk you through the Peebles pediocactus.
Okay.
And it's
two
subspecies.
I can do that. I'm doing it. So
okay.
Watch right now.
Okay. All right. So with that, we will conclude what is part 14. Of a Grand Canyon Oral History with Bart Phillips. Today is Tuesday, April 29th, 2025. My name is Tom Martin, and Bart, thank you so very much.
Okay, thank you.